There is something that is too wonderful for me. Yes, too, that I do not understand. Demons who know their destruction is coming, but who do not try to destroy Jesus. And men who do not know that their destruction is coming, but who try to destroy Jesus. In Mark chapter 1, a couple of weeks ago, we notice how the writer, Mark, shows wicked spirits who know of their destruction, who know who Jesus is, but who do not attempt to destroy Jesus. In verse 24 of Mark 1, a demon said to Jesus, "Let us alone. What have we to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Then in Mark 3, the Bible reveals men, religious leaders who do not know of their destruction, who do not know who Jesus is, but who attempt to destroy Jesus. In Mark 3 and verse 6, it says, "Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him." What shall each of us do with Jesus? Let's pick up now where we left off last week at verse 18 of Mark chapter 2. And here the question is going to be about fasting. Mark 2, verses 18 through 22. "And the disciples of John and of the Pharisees were fasting. And they came and said to him, 'Why do the disciples of John and of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?' So Jesus said to them, 'Can the friends of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, or else the new piece pulls away from the old, and the tear is made worse. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, or else the new wine bursts the wineskins. The wine is spilled, and the wineskins are ruined. But new wine must be put into new wineskins.'" The purpose of religion is to bring a person back to God. This happens when he or she realizes that he is lower than God, and fasting helps us achieve that goal. Therefore, the disciples of John and of the Pharisees, as well as of most of the world's religions, fast. Yet, the apostles of Christ are not fasting. Why are they neglecting this basic tenet of religion? This is such a fundamental that notice what happens here. The disciples of John side with the disciples of the Pharisees on this matter. And that's not something that happened very often. Before we think more about fasting, I want you to think about the Pharisees for a moment. They grow bolder with every confrontation against the Lord. Back in chapter 2, verse 6, they merely questioned in their own hearts what Jesus was doing. In verse 16, they do not keep their criticisms to themselves, but they don't bring it up to Jesus, but to his disciples. Now in chapter 2, verse 18, they grow bold enough to question Jesus directly. In chapter 3, verse 2, we will see them becoming active in looking for something wrong for Jesus. And then in verse 6 of chapter 3, they actually start making plans to destroy him. And from that moment on, their plotting will hang over the rest of the story, hastening his death. Should the disciples of Christ fast? Jesus illustrates that there is a time to fast and a time to eat. Fasting is a time of deep reflection, often brought on by sorrow, such as by the death of a loved one. Jesus is still with his disciples, therefore they have no reason to fast. Soon Jesus will be gone, then the disciples will fast. Do we fast at a wedding? What would you think if the families at a wedding requested that everyone fast on the day of the wedding? Well, there would be nothing wrong with it, but it would seem odd, wouldn't it? It would seem out of context, because celebrating and eating go together. And we certainly do a lot of celebrating, don't we? Therefore, it is appropriate for Christians today to fast, even as the early church did, because Jesus has been taken away from us. The early church fasted when they had a special time of ministering to the Lord, or appointing elders, or when it was forced upon them as a form of persecution, or as self-imposed suffering for the sake of the church. Matthew 6 shows that Jesus did not command fasting, but he knew that in our desire for deep spiritual growth, we would automatically fast. Therefore, he taught the proper way to fast. Listen carefully to his language in Matthew 6, starting at verse 16. Moreover, when you fast, notice right away, moreover, when you fast, here's the way to do it. Do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance. For they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face. In other words, don't make it obvious that you're fasting, that you're experiencing a little bit of suffering. Verse 18, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who sees in the secret place. Now he'll know what you're doing. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Fasting, therefore, is the expression of a deep need in the heart. As 1 Corinthians chapter 7 explains, there will come times when we must be alone or perhaps with another group of people to fast. And the need can be so strong, and we can get into it so much, enjoying the spiritually uplifting moment, that we end up neglecting other duties. And so again, the Bible gives us some regulation here to be careful about that. Speaking to husbands and wives, in verse 5 of 1 Corinthians 7, Paul says this: "Do not deprive one another except with a consent, or with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Another passage I'd like to bring up before we move on back in the text of Mark is Isaiah 58. And I want to encourage you to read the entire chapter of Isaiah 58. I'm just going to read a portion of it at this time. But Isaiah 58 shows that what we just looked at in 1 Corinthians 7 is so important, because we don't want to misuse fasting. Withholding food from ourselves is a form of fasting. But when it comes right down to it, there is another form of fasting that God really wants to see. Starting in verse 3, here's the conversation that God was having with people. "Why have we fasted?" they say, "and you have not seen. Why have we afflicted our souls and you take no notice?" And then God responds, "In fact, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit all your laborers. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush and to spread out sackcloth and ashes?" Addressing the same concern Jesus was. "Oh, look at me. Look at how I'm fasting." No, he said, "That's not what I'm looking for. Would you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord?" Verse 6, "Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him, and not hide yourself from your own flesh?" Now, this passage is not an excuse to avoid fasting from food, nor is fasting, the main point that he's making here, an excuse for neglect of other things. Now, let's go back to Mark chapter 2. The second and third illustrations that Jesus used to explain why his disciples are not fasting, but why they will later, is the mixing of the old and the new. Fasting at the wrong time is as inappropriate as sewing a new piece of cloth on an old one. He says the tear will end up being worse. Or as inappropriate as putting new wine into old wineskins, because then the wineskin would burst. Following Christ is beautiful, easy, and pleasant. Forcing fasting destroys these things. But forbidding fasting, or thinking that someone's weird who fasts, also destroys the spiritual and beautiful wonders of following Jesus Christ. Alright, let's continue now in the text of Mark 2. Verses 23 through 28, the purpose of God's laws. "Now it happened that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. And as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, 'Look, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath?' But he said to them, 'Have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry, he and those with him? How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat, except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him? And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. First, the disciples of Christ are criticized for eating instead of fasting, and when they do eat, they don't do it right. If you do this, we're going to condemn you. If you do that, we've got you there too. It just seems like there will always be a group of people whom you just cannot please. They will rarely have anything good to say, and they will only see what they think in their own minds is wrong, because they have their own ideas about what is right. And if you cross over that, you're in trouble. Now, look at the operation of the Pharisees. Back in verse 16, when the Pharisees thought Christ was in error, who did they approach? His disciples. Now, when they think his disciples are in error, who do they approach? Jesus. Do you see that these men can never be satisfied? And that they will talk behind people's backs? Jesus reminds them of their hero David, who fled from King Saul when the king was trying to kill David. David was not being irreverent in wanting to eat the showbread, but he left his home in a hurry, fleeing from Saul. David was hungry, and the showbread was all that was available, but ultimately it was for man's good anyway. Now, why did God give man the Sabbath or any law? We have a tendency to see God's laws as being restrictive, but God gave us his laws for our good. The Sabbath law did prevent regular work, but it did not prevent emergency work, as in the case of David or in the case of the disciples. Was then, Jesus said, man made for the Sabbath? Or was the Sabbath made for man? Of the two, the Sabbath or man, who is Lord? Well, man is Lord of the Sabbath. Therefore, it was made for him and not man for the Sabbath. God's laws cannot be set aside at our personal whim. He's not teaching that, because they are there for our good. And we need to make sure that good is done. Now let's read the last portion that I want to give you for this morning. Mark 3, verses 1 through 6. It is always right to do good. Here's what Mark writes for us. And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. And they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. Then he said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they kept silent. So when he had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. They watch. They're watching Jesus, but why are they watching? To find fault with him. They cannot see that there's a man in their midst who has a withered hand and needs to be healed, And this man, Jesus, has the power to heal him. Their minds are already made up. They're just looking for an occasion to prove their point and to move them into action. And the Sabbath afforded the best opportunity for that, because the Jews have made many laws in regard to the Sabbath, so it would be impossible not to violate one of those man-made laws. What is lawful to do on the Sabbath? Were the Jews just to sit and do nothing? No. They did worship. They managed to get there to the synagogue to put their hearts, souls, and bodies into worship. That's activity. Therefore, the law did not forbid, that is the law of God, did not forbid every action. And for that matter, even their own laws didn't forbid everything. Now think of the question in verse 4. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do evil? Is it lawful on the Sabbath to save life or to kill? Do you realize what Jesus did with this question? Jesus impales them on the horns of a dilemma. There is an angry bull, and each of his horns represents the only alternatives that the people in question, the Pharisees in this case, have left open for themselves. Since they have embraced error, they condemn themselves or impale themselves. Either way they answer, they're impaled. Because one horn says, the Pharisees are wrong and Jesus is right. And the other horn says, the Pharisees are wrong according to the law. If they say that it is lawful to do good and to save life, they acknowledge that Jesus is right and they're wrong. On the other hand, if they say that it is lawful to do evil and to kill, then they're wrong according to the law of Moses. Jesus is the master logician. So what did the Pharisees do? They think to avoid impaling themselves by keeping silent. However, by their silence, they show that they don't know whether it is lawful to do good and to save life. Therefore, they still stand condemned and impale themselves on a third horn, because I never said it was a bovine bull, but it's a triceratops bull, and he's got three horns. So either way, they're impaled. They're in error. They're condemned. Verse 5 says that Jesus is angry and grieving because their hearts are hardened rather than softened by God's religion. He anticipates their fault-finding, but it does not stop him from doing a good work. He knew that controversy was brewing, so he just meets it head-on. Jesus could have waited until the next day to heal the man. But Jesus never missed an opportunity to teach. The Pharisees were in error in regard to the law of the Sabbath, believing that it restricted everything, including helping people. But in the mind of Jesus, healing on the Sabbath is one of the best times, because it is a time to reflect on the doctrine of God. And that drives us to do good, even as God does good. Now look at the miracle. Jesus gave two simple commands. Step forward. How much work was involved in that? Secondly, he tells the man to stretch out his hand. How much work was involved in that? The man does what he is told, and a miraculous healing takes place. No medicine is used. No physical therapy is prescribed. No wild revival service to whip up the man's emotions is employed. How much work took place? How much work, as far as Jesus was concerned, took place? He did nothing physically except to speak, which is what they would be doing in the synagogue anyways, as they're worshiping. The Jews exerted more work in getting to the synagogue than what Jesus or this man did. What do they think of this miracle? How do they respond to it? Verse 6. They want to destroy Jesus. Excuse me, you want to destroy a man who works miracles? Who can restore a withered hand? Do you guys know with whom you are dealing? Just how successful do they think they're going to be against him? By the way, they unintentionally answer his question of verse 4, don't they? They answer that it is lawful, by implication, they're answering that it is lawful to kill on the Sabbath, or at least the planet. And for what? Making a man better on the Sabbath? Well, it was also because he challenged them. He has the man stand right before them. He presents a question to the Pharisees that singles them out. And then right in front of their faces, he heals the man. And this is all taking place in front of the people who feared the Pharisees. And now Jesus has silenced them. And these men are angry. And they're going to get back at him. Not with a debate, but by killing him. They are not fearful of a man who can do such things. Remember, we've already noticed how he cast out demons out of people. He's healed people of any kind of disease that they have. Would you try to kill somebody like that? And yet, we can do something that seems contradictory, self-contradictory, or against all odds, if we get angry enough. We'll do anything. And they do not see their own evil in plotting to destroy a man. The Pharisees believe that religion evidently is nothing more than external acts, and they see no need to help others, but only to point out error when it violates their tradition. Let us, therefore, all of us, open our hearts to use God's religion for God's purposes. And one of those things is for showing kindness to others, as Jesus has shown to this man here. And the time to do that good work is now. The time for doing a good work is now. And the greatest good work you can do is to save your own soul. Because Jesus did not come into the world merely to restore withered hands, but withered souls. If your soul is withered, why walk away from Jesus? Why not submit your soul to him like this man submitted his hand? And Jesus will do a far greater work for you than he ever did for this man here, provided the man was never converted, but at least in this case of restoring his hand. Does your soul need to be restored? Jesus can restore. He can wash all the sin out of your soul that has caused it to wither. But he needs you to step forward and to stretch out toward him. Are you ready to be baptized into Christ yet this morning? If so, please come forward right now as we stand and sing.